Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of extreme precision.
Right, yeah, like it's a math equation.
Exactly. It's almost like engineering. I mean, you fall off a bike, you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line on the screen, and the doctor just points at it and says, there it is, broken.
Yeah, it's a binary outcome. I mean, you're either injured or you're fine. The intervention is obvious.
Right. But then you step into the world of financial regulation, specifically, trying to figure out what is actually in a client's best
Oh
interest.
boy, yeah.
And suddenly that pristine x-ray machine is completely broken. I mean, we're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is just incredibly murky.
Oh, it's the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Right. It's subjective, it's heavily dependent on context, and honestly, it is full of traps.
It really is. The framework for deciding what's suitable or, in a client's best interest isn't just a single rule. It's this massive interwoven web of obligations. And navigating those waters, understanding the actual why behind every single rule, well, that's exactly what we're doing today.
And real quick, before we jump into those muddy waters, I want to mention this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel.
Yep.
They've got a full Series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's exactly what you need to cut through the noise and pass. Check it out at CERTFuel.com.
I mean, highly recommend checking them out. It's a game changer.
So if you're listening to this right now, you are on a very specific mission. We are mastering best interest and suitability.
Yes, we are.
For those of you tracking the exam blueprint, this is function three of your Series 82 material.
Look, we cannot overstate the importance of this specific function. This is 26% of your entire exam.
That is huge.
It is. Let me emphasize that. Over a quarter of the questions you're going to face are pulled from the concepts we're about to discuss. Getting this framework right, like truly understanding the nuances and the regulatory intent behind these rules, is literally the difference between passing and, well, having to pay to sit for this exam a second time.
Which nobody wants to do. That is a massive chunk of real estate on the test. And because we know that standard, dry textbook lectures are just the absolute enemy of actually retaining complex information,
Oh, the worst.
especially if your brain runs a million miles a minute like mine does. So we are going to approach this a bit
I
differently.
like it.
We're going to build a world. We're going to use a recurring cast of characters to make these highly technical concepts actually stick in your memory.
Let's do it.
So let me introduce the trio we'll be working with today. First up, we have Riley the rep. Riley is a registered representative. He's enthusiastic. He occasionally gets a little too far ahead of his skis, and he just absolutely loves the thrill of closing a sale.
We have all worked with O'Reilly.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he usually has good intentions, but his aggressive sales drive means he constantly needs to be kept within the regulatory guardrails by his compliance department.
Totally. Next, we have his client, Ingrid the investor. Now, Ingrid is independently wealthy. Her financial knowledge is a bit of a roller coaster.
Right.
Sometimes she's incredibly naive about the actual mechanics of high finance, but other times she asks questions that reveal she's surprisingly savvy. So she's our wild card.
I love Ingrid already.
And finally, we have Sam, the sponsor. Sam is a wildly ambitious real estate developer. He structures private placement deals that range from absolute visionary genius to, frankly, terrifying speculative gambles.
Okay, this is the perfect ecosystem for testing suitability. Because before Riley the rep can even begin to think about pitching one of Sam the sponsor's private placements to Ingrid, Riley has to figure out what set of rules he's actually governed by for that specific conversation.
Exactly.
And that brings us to the most fundamental fork in the road for this entire 26% of your exam.
Yeah, you really can't evaluate a single trade until you know which rule book you are holding in your
Well,
hands.
you can.
If you're sitting in the exam center and you get the standard wrong at the very beginning of the prompt, well, every single subsequent answer you give about that scenario is going to be wrong.
Yep, because you're testing the rep's behavior against the wrong legal bar.
Right. So you must choose the standard first. Let's define the two massive territories we're dealing with here.
Okay, so on one side, we have regulation best interest, which the industry almost exclusively calls Reg BI.
Right. Reg BI.
This standard applies whenever a broker-dealer or a rep makes a recommendation to a retail customer. Now, the SEC has a very specific definition here.
They always do.
Yeah, they do. For the purposes of Reg BI, a retail customer is a natural person, meaning an actual breathing human being or the legal representative of that human being.
Okay.
and they have to be using the recommendation primarily for personal, family, or household purposes.
Okay, so natural person, and the money is being used for personal, family, or household reasons. That seems fairly straightforward.
It is, until you contrast it with the other side of the fork.
Yeah.
Because on the other side, we have the FANRA suitability rule.
Ah, the older one.
Right. This older existing rule essentially applies everywhere. RegBI does not. It covers institutional accounts held by non-human entities, so like corporations, pension funds, or large banks.
Okay.
It also covers a natural person who is using the account strictly for business purposes.
All right, let's stress test that boundary with our characters, because I want to see exactly where this breaks down.
Let's do it.
If Ingrid comes to Riley to buy one of Sam's private placements for her personal individual retirement account, her IRA, she's a natural person. It's for her personal retirement, so that is squarely RegBI territory, correct?
Correct. That is a textbook retail customer under RegBI.
But what if Ingrid walks in the next day and says, "Hey, Riley, I'm buying this next tranche of Sam's offering through my commercial real estate LLC, and this investment is strictly for a business purpose to manage corporate cash flow."
Okay.
Is she suddenly stripped of that retail customer protection?
She is. In that second scenario, the purpose of the account dictates the regulatory standard.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, because it's for a business purpose, she leaves the territory of RegBI and falls under the purview of the FANRA suitability rule. What's absolutely vital to understand here is that these two standards never stack on top of each other.
Oh, they don't?
No, they are mutually exclusive by design. FINRA's own rules explicitly state that the suitability rule does not apply to a recommendation that's already subject to RegBI. You're in one lane or the other.
Okay, so it's legally impossible to be cited for violating both RegBI and the suitability rule on the exact same recommendation to the exact same client.
Exactly. The regulators wanted a very clear demarcation line.
Good to know. So, if you're listening to this right now, I want you to mentally pause and evaluate this next scenario.
Because the exam writers love to play with your assumptions here.
Oh, they do. Let's say Riley recommends a massive, complex trade to a natural person. Let's use Ingrid again and establish that she is a multimillionaire. She has incredible wealth, a massive net worth, and she routinely does seven-figure trades.
A whale of a client.
Exactly. But she's using this specific account for her family trust to pass wealth down to her grandchildren.
Okay.
Does RegBI or the suitability rule apply? I want you to think about what actually dictates the standard. Give it a second.
The answer is regulation best interest.
Which feels completely counterintuitive, right?
It really does.
Because when we hear multimillionaire doing seven-figure trades, our brains immediately default to institutional.
And that is exactly the psychological trap the exam relies on. They will throw massive dollar amounts at you to make you think you're dealing with an institutional client. But her wealth does not strip her of her retail customer status under RegBI.
Right, because of the purpose.
Exactly. The test is simply, is she a natural person? And is the purpose personal, family, or household? A family trust, regardless of whether it has $10,000 or $10 billion in it, is for a family purpose. Therefore, RegBI applies.
That is a phenomenal distinction to highlight. The dollar amount does not change the regulatory lane. The legal entity type and the purpose of the funds change the lane.
Exactly. Now, while we're talking about institutional clients and exam craps, there is a massive nuance hiding inside the suitability rule that you absolutely must be aware of. It's called the institutional exemption.
Let's unpack that, because exemptions are always highly testable.
They are. So let's say Riley is dealing with a true institutional account, like an actual corporation or a massive hedge fund. They're governed by the suitability rule.
Right.
However, they can escape one very specific component of that rule. They can be exempt from customer-specific suitability. But they only earn that exemption if two rigid conditions are met.
What are they?
First, Riley or his firm must have a reasonable basis to believe that the institutional customer, or their delegated agent, is fully capable of evaluating investment risk independently.
Meaning, they aren't relying on Riley to hold their hand. They have their own analysts, their own quants, their own ability to tear a prospectus apart.
Right. And second, the institutional customer, or their agent, must affirmatively indicate to the firm that they are, in fact, exercising independent judgment in evaluating the recommendations.
So they have to actually raise their hand formally and say, yes, we are making our own independent decisions here. We are not relying on you for suitability.
Yes, they have to opt into that independent status. Mm-hmm. But here is the critical trap the exam will spring on you.
Oh, I'm ready.
If a firm meets those two conditions, and the institutional client signs off on exercising independent judgment, does the entire suitability rule just magically evaporate?
Well, if I'm tracking the exact language you just used, the answer has to be no. You specifically said it only removes customer-specific suitability.
That is the exact correct deduction. Reasonable basis suitability and quantitative suitability still fully apply to that institutional account. The exam question will likely tell a story about an incredibly sophisticated hedge fund that signed the independent judgment waiver. And then Riley recommends a completely fraudulent, structurally unsound product. The answer choices will try to bait you into saying, well, Riley is innocent because the institutional exemption removed all suitability obligations.
And that's entirely false.
Completely false.
That makes a lot of sense from a regulatory standpoint. The SEC and FINRA are basically saying, okay, the institution is smart enough to figure out if this fits their specific portfolio, so we'll drop the customer-specific requirement.
Right.
But Riley, you still can't sell them absolute garbage that has no reasonable basis, and you still can't aggressively churn their account.
Exactly. The foundational protections remain intact. The institution can fend for itself regarding its own portfolio fit, but the broker-dealer still has to act like a professional entity.
All right, so that establishes the gateway. Riley knows how to figure out which rulebook to open. Let's operate under the assumption that he's dealing with Ingrid for her personal retirement account.
Okay, natural person, personal purpose.
Exactly. He is solidly in Reg BI territory. Once he is inside that territory, what does he actually have to execute?
Under regulation best interest, a broker-dealer and its associated persons must satisfy four distinct component obligations. If you miss even one of these, you have violated Reg BI.
Okay, four pillars.
They are disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance. Meeting the overarching best interest standard means satisfying all four of these pillars concurrently and fundamentally, never placing the firm's or the rep's financial or other interests ahead of the retail customer's interest.
Let's take those one by one because I know each of those pillars has significant depth. Let's start with disclosure. What exactly is Riley disclosing?
Before or at the time of the recommendation, Riley's firm must provide Ingrid, in writing, a full and fair disclosure of all material facts relating to the scope and terms of their relationship.
What does that mean, practically?
This means he has to disclose all fees, all costs that apply to her transactions, the type and scope of services being provided, and crucially, all material facts relating to any conflicts of interest associated with the recommendation.
So it's heavily focused on transparency regarding how Riley is getting paid and what it's going to cost Ingrid.
Yes.
Now, I want to pause here and look at a massive regulatory landmine. If you are taking the Series 82, you are going to see a caution about Form CRS, the Customer Relationship Summary.
Oh, guaranteed.
The exam is going to set up a scenario where Riley hands Ingrid a beautifully printed Form CRS when she opens her account. Then a month later, he recommends a complex private placement. The question will ask, did Riley satisfy the Reg BI disclosure obligation regarding this recommendation by providing Form CRS at account opening?
And this is where test takers routinely stumble. What is the correct analysis?
The analysis is that Form CRS and the Reg BI disclosure obligation are two completely separate regulatory beasts. Providing Form CRS never, ever satisfies the Reg BI disclosure obligation for a specific recommendation on its own.
That is a vital point to master. Let's explain why they're different, because understanding the regulatory intent makes it impossible to forget.
Go for it.
Form CRS is mandated by a separate SEC rule. It's designed to be a high-level, standardized, 2-to-4-page summary. It helps a retail investor understand generally what type of firm they are dealing with. Are they a broker-dealer, an investment advisor, or both? What general fees do they charge? It is an introductory relationship document.
It's basically the elevator pitch of the firm's legal structure.
Exactly. The Reg BI disclosure obligation, on the other hand, is transaction and relationship specific. It requires full and fair disclosure of the specific material facts about the specific recommendation being made today.
Oh, that's a huge difference.
Right. A generic form CRS handed over a month ago cannot possibly disclose the specific conflicts of interest and exact costs associated with Sam the sponsor's brand new real estate private placement that Riley is pitching today.
So if a rep tries to use Form CRS as a blanket shield for their Reg BI disclosure duties, they are going to get crushed by compliance.
Absolutely crushed. They are separate duties and both must be fulfilled.
Okay, that covers the disclosure pillar. Let's dive into the second pillar, care. I know this one is highly structured.
The care obligation is the analytical heart of Reg BI. It forces the rep to follow a three-step sequence. You must evaluate the product, then the customer, then the overall pattern of recommendations.
Let's break down step one, evaluating the product.
Step one requires Riley to exercise reasonable diligence, care, and skill to understand the potential risks, rewards, and costs associated with the recommendation. He must then form a reasonable basis to believe that this specific product could be in the best interest of at least some retail customers.
So this is purely a product-level analysis. Riley can't pitch Sam's strip mall private placement if Riley hasn't read the private placement memorandum, doesn't understand the fee structure, or doesn't know how the underlying real estate actually generates yield.
Precisely. If you don't understand the mechanics of what you are selling, you violate the care obligation before you even speak to a client.
Assuming he passes that knowledge test, what is step two?
Step two brings the specific client into the equation. Riley must have a reasonable basis to believe that the recommendation is in the best interest of this particular retail customer, Ingrid.
Okay.
He bases this entirely on her specific investment profile. And here is the crucial legal phrasing. He must do this without placing his financial or other interests or his firm's interests ahead of Ingrid's interest.
So he has to match the product to her profile and ensure his commission isn't the driving factor of the match. And step three.
Step three zooms out to look at the portfolio level. Riley needs a reasonable basis to believe that a series of recommended transactions, even if they appear suitable individually, is not excessive when taken together.
Right.
It must be in Ingrid's best interest overall. And again, the rule explicitly states he must not place his or the firm's interest ahead of hers.
Okay, I'm noticing a very specific legal pattern here, and it feels like a massive exam gotcha.
Let's hear it.
The rule explicitly includes the phrase, do not put your interest ahead of the customer's for step two, which is fitting the specific customer, and step three, which is evaluating the series of trades. But it completely omitted that phrase for step one, understanding the product.
That is an incredibly sharp reading of the rule. And yes, it is a frequent point of confusion that exam writers love to exploit.
I knew it.
The conflict of interest provision, the mandate to not put your interests first, is fundamentally attached to the client-facing steps, but it does not legally attach to step one.
But why not? Why wouldn't the SEC want reps to avoid conflicts when evaluating a product?
Because step one, understanding the product, is essentially just a technical knowledge test. You're analyzing the mathematical mechanics, the legal risks, and the internal costs of a security in a vacuum. You cannot technically have a conflict of interest with a math problem or a legal document.
No. That makes sense.
The conflict test only becomes legally relevant once an actual human customer is introduced into the equation,
yeah.
And you have to weigh their interests against your own compensation.
That completely reframes how I view that rule. So an exam question might describe a scenario where Riley recommends a highly complex derivative product that he completely fails to understand. He just didn't do the reading.
Right.
The answer choice will likely say, Riley violated Reg BI by putting his financial interests ahead of the customers, and that would be a trap because he failed the knowledge test, step one, not the conflict test of step two.
Exactly. He failed the first component of the care obligation. He was negligent in his diligence. Whether he had a conflict of interest is actually a secondary issue to the fact that he didn't know what he was selling.
Fascinating. Okay, moving to the third pillar of Reg BI, the conflict of interest obligation. We just talked about not letting conflicts influence the recommendation, but this pillar is about how the firm handles them structurally, right?
Yes. The conflict of interest obligation applies primarily to the broker-dealer firm itself, rather than just the individual rep. The firm must establish, maintain, and enforce written policies and procedures reasonably designed to identify and, at a minimum, disclose or eliminate all conflicts of interest associated with recommendations.
Disclose or eliminate. So just telling the client about the conflict isn't always enough.
That is a massive shift brought about by Reg BI. Under older standards, disclosure was often seen as the ultimate cure-all. If you buried the conflict in page 40 of a prospectus, you were legally safe.
Yeah.
Reg BI says that is no longer sufficient. Some conflicts are so inherently toxic that they cannot be cured by disclosure. They must be mitigated or, in some cases, outright eliminated.
What's an example of a conflict that a firm would be forced to eliminate entirely?
The SEC explicitly targeted sales contests, sales quotas, bonuses, or non-cash compensation that are based on the sales of specific securities or specific types of securities within a limited time period.
So if Riley's firm says, whoever sells the most of Sam's real estate private placements this month wins a trip to Hawaii, That is a conflict that cannot just be disclosed. They can't just tell Ingrid, hey, if I sell this to you, I go to Hawaii.
Correct.
The firm actually has to eliminate that contest entirely.
Exactly. The regulatory view is that a time-bound contest for a specific product creates an incentive so powerful that it makes it nearly impossible for the rep to truly act in the customer's best interest. It corrupts the care obligation. Therefore, the conflict obligation mandates that the firm must eliminate that specific type of incentive program.
That makes total sense. And that transitions perfectly into the fourth pillar.
Compliance.
The compliance obligation simply requires the broker-dealer to establish, maintain, and enforce written policies and procedures reasonably designed to achieve compliance with regulation best interest as a whole.
It's the administrative framework that ensures the other three pillars are actually being executed in the real world rather than just existing as theoretical concepts.
It's the enforcement mechanism. Okay, before we leave RegBI, I want to address a huge misconception. When I hear the words best interest, my immediate assumption is that Riley is legally obligated to scour the market and find the absolute cheapest product for Ingrid.
A lot of people think that.
Right. Look, if Sam has a private placement with a 5% upfront fee and another sponsor has a similar one with a 2% fee, RegBI means Riley has to pick the 2% one or he goes to regulatory jail.
That is perhaps the most common misconception in the industry regarding RegBI. Regulation best interest does not equate to a mandate to simply find the cheapest product or the product that pays the rep the lowest commission.
Well, if that were true, the entire industry would just be mandated into zero-fee index funds by default. Cost has to be a factor, obviously, but it can't be the only factor. I mean, it's like saying the best interest car for a family of six is a two-seater go-kart purely because it happens to be the cheapest vehicle on the lot.
I love that analogy.
Right. Like, yes, cost is important, but a go-kart fundamentally fails to fit the family's profile or objective.
It perfectly captures the regulatory reality. Cost must always be considered. You absolutely cannot ignore it. If you recommend a significantly more expensive product without a valid, documented reason for why it is superior based on the customer's profile, you have breached the care obligation.
Okay.
But if the more expensive product offers better liquidity, a superior risk-adjusted return profile, access to a specific sector the client needs, or aligns perfectly with Ingrid's complex tax situation,
then it works.
Yes, it can absolutely be in her best interest over the cheaper, generic option.
It requires actual professional judgment, not just sorting a spreadsheet by a lowest fee.
Exactly. The SEC wants reps to act as thoughtful professionals, not algorithms that simply default to the lowest price tag.
All right, so that comprehensively covers RegBI, which is for retail customers with personal purposes. Now, let's flip the script.
Let's do it.
Let's move to the other side of the fork we talked about earlier. What if Riley is dealing with an institutional client? Let's say Ingrid comes back to Riley's office, but this time she's representing a massive corporate pension fund she manages. She's buying strictly for business purposes.
Okay.
Riley leaves RegBI and enters the Fenere suitability rule. How do his obligations change?
Under the suitability rule, Riley's duties are structured differently. Instead of four pillars, the suitability rule is built from three distinct component obligations. They are reasonable basis suitability, customer-specific suitability, and quantitative suitability.
If I'm looking at those from the firm's perspective, they sound very similar to the steps of the RegBI care obligation.
They are the evolutionary ancestors of the RegBI care steps, yes.
Best.
First, reasonable basis suitability. This is entirely about the product. The rep and the firm must perform diligence to understand the nature, risks, and rewards of the security. They must have a reasonable basis to believe the recommendation is suitable for at least some investors. If Riley doesn't understand the product, he fails this immediately, regardless of who the client is.
Which mirrors step one of RegBI.
Exactly. Second is customer-specific suitability. This tests whether the product fits this particular customer. Riley must have a reasonable basis to believe the recommendation is suitable for Ingrid's pension fund, based entirely on the fund's specific investment profile.
And then the third is quantitative suitability.
Right. Quantitative suitability focuses on the rep's control over an account. It dictates that a rep who has actual or de facto control over a customer account must have a reasonable basis for believing that a series of recommended transactions, even if every single trade is suitable when viewed in isolation, are not excessive and unsuitable for the customer when taken together in light of their investment profile.
Okay, I want to zoom in heavily on that last one. Quantitative suitability. A series of trades being deemed excessive. When anyone in finance hears about a rep doing excessive trading in an account they control, their mind immediately jumps to one word, churning.
Yep.
Are quantitative suitability and churning just two different regulatory terms for the exact same crime?
They're absolutely not the same thing, and the exam will aggressively test your ability to separate them. They share similarities, like both involve too much trading, but the legal requirements to prove them are entirely different.
Break that down for me, because I need a clear way to tell them apart when I'm reading a dense exam prompt.
To prove churning, regulators must establish a very specific malicious mental state. Churning requires proving two elements. First, that the rep had control over the account. Second, and most importantly, that the rep acted with the intent to defraud the customer or to generate commissions for themselves with a reckless disregard for the customer's interests.
Wow.
Churning is intentional, malicious theft via commissions.
Control and malicious intent.
Yes. Quantitative suitability, on the other hand, is a much broader standard. A failure of quantitative suitability does require control over the account, but does not require any proof of malicious intent to defraud or generate commissions.
Interesting.
It simply requires looking at the mathematical reality of the account, the turnover rate, the cost to equity ratio, and concluding that the sheer volume of trades was objectively excessive and therefore unsuitable for that client's profile.
Okay, so it is the difference between malicious intent and gross negligence. Let me try an analogy.
I'm ready.
Churning is like intentionally stealing a taxi, hijacking the driver, and deliberately driving in circles around the city for 6 hours.
Yeah.
You have control of the car, and your specific malicious intent is to run up the meter as high as possible so you can pocket a massive fare from the hostage in the back seat.
Oh, I like it. It captures the predatory nature of churning perfectly. And how does that contrast with quantitative suitability?
A failure of quantitative suitability is just being an incredibly reckless, terrible driver. You aren't holding anyone hostage, and you don't have a master plan to run up the meter. You just keep taking wrong turns, driving over curbs, missing exits, and taking the absolute most inefficient routes possible.
Right.
Ultimately, you ruin the car and waste a massive amount of the passenger's time and money. It's objectively excessive and unsuitable driving, but it lacks the specific malicious intent of the taxi hijacker.
That analogy works perfectly. The exam will frequently give you a scenario where a rep recommends way too many trades, the account value drops due to fees, but there is absolutely no mention of the rep doing it deliberately to harvest commissions.
So it's not churning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you see that scenario and you select churning as the violation, you will get it wrong. Because intent isn't proven in the prompt, the correct answer is a failure of quantitative suitability.
That is a subtle but critical legal distinction. What else is the exam going to try and trick me on regarding the suitability rule?
They love to test the difference between the Know Your Customer rule, which is often abbreviated as KYC, and the suitability rule's investment profile.
Okay, let's set that up. Let's say Riley gets Ingrid to fill out a standard new account form. It's got her name, her physical address, the fact that her daughter is her trusted contact, and her social security number.
Right, the basics.
Right. Riley looks at that form and says, great, I know my customer, so I am going to use this document to justify putting her into a highly leveraged speculative options strategy. What happens next?
What happens next is Riley gets fired by his compliance officer.
Obviously.
And that is exactly the exam trap. That basic form represents KYC. The Know Your Customer rule, MRR rule 2090, is essentially an administrative and operational mandate. It requires firms to use reasonable diligence to gather essential facts simply to open and service the account.
Service the account, meaning the mechanical realities of being a broker.
Exactly. Who has the legal authority to place a trade? Are there special handling instructions for statements? What is their physical address for tax reporting? That is KYC. It's about operational identity. It is not about financial psychology or risk capacity.
Which brings us to the investment profile.
Right. The investment profile is embedded within the suitability rule itself, FINRA Rule 2111. It's a highly specific list of metrics used to evaluate the actual financial viability of a recommendation.
What's on the list?
It includes the customer's age, other investments, financial situation and needs, tax status, investment objectives, investment experience, investment time horizon, liquidity needs, and risk tolerance.
So KYC is who are you and how do we process your paperwork, while the investment profile is what are your financial debts made of so we don't bankrupt you with the wrong trade.
Exactly. Do not mix up the lists. If an exam question asks what information is necessary to gather essential facts to simply service an account, they're pointing you toward KYC. If they ask what specific data points are required to evaluate whether a recommendation is suitable, they are demanding the components of the investment profile.
Makes sense. So if you're listening on your commute right now, ask yourself this. What happens when the sequence of these rules gets broken?
A great question.
Think about this scenario. Riley the rep is sitting in a training seminar for a highly complex new private placement, but Riley completely zones out. He's looking at his phone. He leaves the seminar with absolutely no idea how this product actually works.
Classic Riley.
Right. He doesn't understand the liquidity risks. He doesn't understand the fee structure. He doesn't know what the underlying asset is. But he goes back to his desk and recommends it to Ingrid anyway. Now, by pure, sheer, dumb luck, this incredibly complex product actually happens to perfectly fit Ingrid's highly specific investment profile. Her time horizon, risk tolerance, and tax status align perfectly with what the product does. Did Riley violate a FINRA rule? I'll give you a second to think about the sequence.
The answer is yes. He absolutely violated the suitability rule.
But the outcome was fine. The product fit her profile perfectly. No harm, no foul, right?
There is both harm and foul from a regulatory perspective. He failed reasonable basis suitability. Remember the sequence we discussed. You must evaluate and understand the product first before you even look at the customer.
Right.
Because Riley didn't understand the product's risks and rewards, reasonable basis suitability fails immediately at step one. The fact that the product happened to fit Ingrid by dumb luck at step two is legally irrelevant.
That is wild, but it makes perfect sense when you look at the intent of the rule. FNRI is saying you can't just throw darts blindfolded and claim you're a financial genius when you accidentally hit the bullseye. The process matters just as much as the outcome.
Exactly. A broken process that yields a good result is still a regulatory violation.
Okay, so Riley now thoroughly understands the rules of the road. He knows whether he's operating under Reg BI or suitability, and he knows he has to understand the product first. But that is just the regulatory framework.
Right.
The actual vehicle he chooses to put Ingrid into matters just as much. And that brings us to the actual products. Specifically, how the fundamental structural difference between equity and debt is itself a massive suitability judgment.
It is entirely a suitability judgment. When you recommend a security, you aren't just matching a dollar amount to a client's net worth. You're matching a specific legal structure and claim priority to their financial objective. In the realm of private placements, you're generally looking at two foundational structures, equity and debt.
Let's break those down, starting with equity. If Riley sells Ingrid an equity position in Sam's company, what is she actually buying?
Equity gives the investor an actual ownership stake in the issuing entity. Because they are owners, they hold what is called a residual claim on the issuer's assets and earnings.
Residual claim meaning they get whatever is left over after everyone else is paid.
Correct. Therefore, equity is generally oriented toward growth or capital appreciation. If the company succeeds massively, the owners capture that unlimited upside. But crucially, equity is structurally subordinate to the issuer's creditors if the company goes bankrupt.
So if things go south.
Meaning if Sam's real estate empire collapses and gets liquidated, the equity holders, the owners, are the absolute last ones in line to get whatever pennies remain. Often they are entirely wiped out.
So equity means ownership, unlimited growth potential, but structurally subordinate in a worst case scenario. You are at the back of the line. What about debt?
A debt instrument fundamentally changes the relationship. The investor is not an owner, they're a creditor. They have simply loaned the company money. This comes with a strict contractual right to receive regular interest payments and the eventual repayment of their principal amount.
So they don't capture the massive upside if the company becomes a billion-dollar unicorn, but they get steady checks.
Right. Debt is inherently oriented toward current income and capital preservation. And structurally, it holds a senior claim relative to equity holders.
Yeah.
If Sam's ship sinks, the creditors have a legally superior claim on the assets. They get to the lifeboats before the owners do.
Let's run a scenario to see how reps get this wrong in the real world. Let's bring Ingrid back.
Okay.
Ingrid walks into Riley's office. We have already established that she is massively wealthy. Let's say she has practically infinite risk capacity for this specific account. She could lose $5 million on a deal, and her lifestyle wouldn't change one bit.
Must be nice.
Must be nice, yeah. But she explicitly tells Riley that her specific investment objective for this account is strictly current income. She wants steady checks arriving every quarter to fund a specific charitable foundation she runs.
Okay, the objective is clearly defined as current income.
Riley turns around and sells her one of Sam the sponsor's equity private placements. It pays absolutely zero current distributions. It is a pure long-term growth play on undeveloped land. But Riley justifies it in his notes by saying, well, the client is a billionaire. She has infinite risk capacity. She can easily afford to lose the principal if the land deal goes bad. So this high-risk equity is totally suitable. Is Riley Safier?
Riley is completely exposed. He has failed his suitability analysis on a fundamental level.
But she has infinite risk capacity. She can afford the loss.
Can afford to lose the principal is not the same regulatory test as matches the investment objective. This is a massive classic exam trap. The exam writers will deliberately try to blind you with the customer's immense wealth or high risk tolerance, trying to bait you into ignoring their actual explicitly stated objective.
That is so true. We see a rich client in a question and our brains assume, oh, they're rich, they can buy anything, the rules don't apply.
Exactly. But the fundamental structure of the product must match the client's objective. If the objective is current income, the structure needs to lean toward debt or perhaps a specifically engineered income-producing equity. But it certainly cannot be a zero distribution, pure growth equity play.
Yeah.
If the objective is growth, the structure should lean equity. You cannot let a customer's ability to absorb a massive financial loss serve as a substitute for checking whether the product's actual legal structure does what they hired you to do.
So wealth does not override objective. Capacity does not override intent. Got it. But that implies we're only looking at one trade in isolation. In reality, Riley didn't just sell Ingrid one single product. He is managing her entire portfolio. And suitability doesn't happen in a vacuum, does it?
That is a critical transition. A robust suitability review has to weigh how a new single position changes the overall composition and risk profile of everything the customer already holds. The portfolio view is paramount.
Give me a practical example of how looking at the broader portfolio can actually kill what looks like a good trade.
Let's say Riley finds a moderately risky technology private placement. Evaluated completely on its own, it passes reasonable basis suitability, and it seems to generally fit Ingrid's profile.
Okay.
But if Riley actually looks at her existing portfolio, he might realize she is already 90% invested in high-risk tech startups through other channels. Recommending this new tech position duplicates her existing risk. It pushes her concentration in one sector over the edge into dangerous territory. Therefore, a product that is suitable in isolation becomes unsuitable because of the portfolio context.
Okay, so the portfolio context can turn a yes into a no. Can it work in reverse? Can the portfolio view actually save a trade that looks terrible on its own?
Yes. The SEC explicitly noted this dynamic when they adopted RegBI. You might have a product that looks incredibly risky or speculative on its own, say a highly complex hedging instrument, a volatility derivative, or a speculative option strategy. Mm-hmm. If you just looked at that single product and a conservative client, you'd immediately say, absolutely not suitable.
Right. Conservative clients shouldn't be buying complex derivatives.
But if you look at their entire portfolio and realize that the risky instrument is being purchased specifically to hedge against a massive concentrated risk they already hold, the calculus changes. Adding that risky product might actually act as insurance, making their overall aggregate portfolio more conservative and balanced.
Wow.
Therefore, the risky trade becomes highly suitable because of the portfolio context.
Context truly is everything. The piece of the puzzle only makes sense when you see the whole board.
Exactly.
Let's talk about diversification, because I feel like that word gets thrown around a lot by reps to justify sales, but they don't actually understand what it means mechanically. Let me pose a scenario. Riley puts Ingrid into 5 different private placements over the course of a year. On paper, there are technically 5 separate, legally distinct LLCs. But if you look closely at the offering documents, all 5 of these LLCs are sponsored by Sam the Sponsor, and all 5 are building retail strip malls in the exact same suburban city.
Is Ingrid diversified?
No. She is absolutely, unequivocally not diversified.
But she owns 5 different companies. If one goes bankrupt, the other 4 are separate legal entities.
Issue count alone does not prove diversification. This is a critical analytical concept for the exam. You have to look past the sheer number of issues or the legal boundaries of the LLCs, and you must look for correlated risk.
Correlated risk, meaning the underlying economic factors that would cause one to fail would simultaneously cause the others to fail.
Exactly. In your scenario, the correlated risks are massive and overlapping. First, they share the same sponsor, Sam. If Sam mismanages his firm, gets indicted for fraud, or goes personally bankrupt, all 5 LLCs likely crash due to key person risk.
Second, they share the exact same industry. Retail real estate. If a macro trend like e-commerce accelerates and wipes out brick-and-mortar stores, all 5 crash because their tenants will default. Third, they share the exact same geography. If that specific city's local economy tanks, a major employer leaves, or local property taxes spike, all five crash.
That's a nightmare scenario.
Right. That is not a diversified portfolio. That is basically one highly concentrated, extremely risky position wearing five different legal hats.
That is a phenomenal visual. One massive risk wearing five different hats. Okay, so if that isn't diversification, how do we actually balance a portfolio? What is the official regulatory magic ratio? What is the FANRA approved mix of risk-averse safe securities versus speculative securities? Is it 60-40, 30?
There's no magic ratio. There is no fixed industry rule of thumb written in any FANRA manual.
Wait, really? The regulators don't provide a baseline percentage.
None whatsoever. The appropriate mix of conservative risk-averse securities versus speculative securities is derived entirely from the individual customer's specific capacity to risk the loss of their principal and their income.
So adding speculative exposure to a portfolio isn't automatically viewed as a bad or dangerous thing by regulators.
Not at all. If the customer has high financial capacity to absorb losses, significant investment experience, and an aggressive growth objective, increasing speculative exposure might be exactly what is required to meet their goals.
And conversely, putting a client 100% into risk-averse, super-safe treasury bonds isn't automatically a good or safe recommendation.
Correct. Imagine a 30-year-old client with a 40-year time horizon until retirement. They need aggressive capital growth to outpace decades of inflation. If a rep puts them 100% into risk-averse short-term treasury bills, they're practically guaranteeing that the client will fail to meet their retirement goals because their purchasing power will be eroded by inflation.
That makes total sense.
That would be a fundamentally unsuitable recommendation, even though the product itself is universally considered safe. The test is always the individual customer's capacity and objective, never a fixed universal percentage.
I love that. It forces the rep to actually do the hard work of knowing the human being across the desk rather than just plugging them into a one-size-fits-all pie chart.
Exactly.
Okay, speaking of capacity, let's take this concept to the absolute extreme limit. Let's say Ingrid comes to Riley and says, "Riley, I am bored with diversification. I don't want a balanced portfolio. I want to put 80% of my liquid net worth into Sam's craziest, most speculative, leveraged strip mall project. I want to heavily concentrate my portfolio." Can Riley legally execute that?
He can, but it is fraught with regulatory peril. Recommending or facilitating a heavily concentrated or highly speculative portfolio requires the customer to pass a very specific, rigid two-part test. The client must possess two very distinct attributes at the exact same time.
What are the two halves of the test?
Number one is holding power. This is the raw financial ability to hold the securities through extreme, protracted market fluctuations without being forced to liquidate the position at a loss just to pay for basic living expenses or meet margin calls.
Basically, you need deep, deep pockets. You need the financial stamina to bleed for a while without dying.
Yes. Number two is investment management talent. This means the client possesses significant financial sophistication, deep market experience, or specific knowledge relevant to managing a highly concentrated or speculative portfolio.
Okay, I have an analogy for this, and it involves large predatory cats.
Okay, let's hear it.
Recommending a concentrated speculative portfolio is exactly like a client deciding they want to own a literal live tiger as a house pet.
I am highly intrigued. Let's explore the tiger analogy.
If you want to safely own a tiger, you need two distinct things. First, you need holding power. In this scenario, holding power is a giant, incredibly expensive, custom-built steel cage. You need the raw financial resources to house the beast safely so it doesn't destroy your house. Second, you need investment management talent, which means you need to be a professional, highly experienced tiger trainer who understands the behavior of the animal.
Okay, the pieces are fitting together.
Now, look at what happens if you only have one half of the equation. If you only have the cage, meaning you have the money and the holding power, but you have absolutely no talent, you are just a rich amateur. You are going to walk into that cage to feed the tiger one day, you'll make a rookie mistake, and you will get eaten alive.
A painful liquidation.
Exactly. But look at the reverse. If you're a brilliant, world-renowned tiger trainer, you have massive talent, but you are broke, and you don't have the money to buy the steel cage. Well, the tiger is going to escape into the neighborhood and ruin your life because you couldn't contain it. You have to have the cage, A&E, the training talent at the exact same time. If you only have one, it is a guaranteed disaster.
That is surprisingly accurate, and it perfectly illustrates the psychological traps the exam writers will set for you on this specific topic. The exam loves to test this by presenting a scenario where the client possesses only one half of the requirement and asking if the speculative trade is suitable.
Let's hear how they structure those traps.
Trap number one, the clueless billionaire. The exam prompt will describe a client who won the lottery or inherited $3 billion yesterday. However, their entire life prior to yesterday was spent working a minimum wage job, and they've never invested in anything more complex than a basic checking account.
Okay.
They have infinite holding power. They can buy the biggest deal cage in the world, but they have zero management talent. Are they suitable for a highly concentrated speculative derivatives portfolio?
Wow. They have the cage, but they're going to get eaten by the market because they don't know what they are doing. Wealth does not equal sophistication.
Correct. Trap number two, the broke genius. The exam describes a brilliant former hedge fund manager. He has 3 decades of experience trading the most complex arcane derivatives on Wall Street. He is a master tiger trainer.
Sounds promising.
But the prompt casually mentions he recently lost his entire personal fortune in a messy divorce and currently has a total net worth of $10,000. He wants to put $9,000 of it into a highly speculative, illiquid private placement.
Oh man, he has the talent, but he doesn't have the holding power. If that illiquid private placement dips in value or delays a distribution, he can't pay his rent. He has no cage to contain the volatility. So the recommendation is completely unsuitable.
Exactly.
The regulatory rule requires both. Financial capacity alone is not enough to justify extreme speculation. Sophistication alone is not enough. When you read an exam prompt about concentration or speculation, you must act like a detective and aggressively scan the fact pattern to ensure both halves of that test, the wealth and the knowledge, are explicitly established before you score the recommendation as suitable. Page and trainer, holding power and talent. If they don't have both, do not let them buy the tiger.
Okay, we are going to pivot hard here because up until this exact moment, we have been operating under a very specific assumption. We've assumed that Riley the rep and Sam the sponsor are totally separate people working for totally separate independent companies. Riley evaluates Sam's deals from a distance, but what happens if they aren't independent? This brings us to a massive regulatory area. When the firm is the issuer, also known as the member private offering rule, or the MPO rule.
This is an area where FinAustin heavily scrutinizes behavior because the conflicts of interest are not just present, they are structurally massive. The member private offering rule kicks in when a broker-dealer is placing unregistered securities where the firm itself, or a control entity of the firm, is the actual issuer of the securities being sold. Let's make that concrete. So instead of Riley selling Sam's real estate deal, Riley's brokerage firm is the entity actually creating the private placement, issuing the shares, and using its own brokers to raise money from retail clients to fund the firm's own internal operations.
Exactly. Or it's a control entity. Finera defines control as having a beneficial interest of more than 50% of the voting securities of an entity, or the right to more than 50% of the distributable profits.
Okay.
So if Riley's broker-dealer firm owns 51% of Sam's real estate LLC, Sam's LLC is legally deemed a control entity of the broker-dealer. Therefore, the MPO rule applies to that offering.
Wow. Okay. So Riley is essentially selling his own parent company's stock to Ingrid while pretending it's just another investment opportunity. That seems wildly ripe for abuse. Why did Fanera feel the need to write a specific rule for this?
Because the history of the industry is littered with catastrophic abuses in this exact scenario. Historically, you'd see shady broker-dealers set up an in-house private placement. They would raise $10 million from their own trusting clients, ostensibly to fund a new business venture.
But let me guess.
Yeah, they would siphon off $4 million of that raise as syndication fees, consulting fees, or massive sales commissions paid back to themselves. The clients thought they were funding a real estate project, but they were mostly just funding the broker-dealer's executive bonus pool.
That is horrifying.
The business venture would inevitably fail because it was starved of capital, the clients would lose everything, and the broker-dealer kept the fees.
So how does the MPO rule actually stop them from doing that?
The MPO rule imposes 3 strict conditions that a member firm must meet if they want to sell their own private offerings. Disclosure, filing, and use of proceeds.
Let's take them one by one. How does the disclosure condition work in an MPO?
The disclosure condition actually carries 2 distinct duties, and the exam will absolutely try to trick you by offering a scenario where only one is met. First, the offering document itself, usually a private placement memorandum or a term sheet, must explicitly and clearly disclose the intended use of the offering proceeds. It must also detail the offering expenses and the exact selling compensation being paid to the member firm and its reps.
So you have to write down in plain English exactly where every dollar is going and exactly how much Riley is pocketing for selling his own firm's deal.
Right. But creating that document is only duty number one. Duty number two is that this document must be physically or electronically provided to each prospective investor.
Why is that a trick? Doesn't everyone hand out the document?
Not always. A member firm might spend $50,000 having high-priced lawyers draft a beautiful, perfectly compliant 100-page disclosure document that lists every conflict of interest. But then the sales reps just leave the document sitting in a filing cabinet or buried on an intranet site while they pitch the deal verbally over the phone. The firm met the content duty by creating the document, but they fundamentally failed the delivery duty. If you don't actually put it in the investor's hands before they buy, you fail the MPO disclosure condition.
Got it. You have to write it AND, you have to hand it over. What about the filing condition?
Transparency to the regulator is just as important as transparency to the client. The firm must file the offering document and any retail communication used to promote it with FinFineRI's corporate financing department. The timing here is the critical testable point. It must be filed at or before the first time it is provided to any prospective investor.
At or before first use. So you can't test market it for a month and then file it if it goes well.
Correct. And if they update the document later, say they change the fee structure or add a new risk factor, those amendments must be filed within 10 days of being provided to an investor.
Okay, so we have disclosure and filing. What is the third condition? This feels like it should be the hammer that stops the abuse we talked about earlier.
It is the hammer. The third condition governs the use of proceeds. The rule dictates that at least 85% of the offering proceeds must be deployed for the actual business purposes of the issuer.
85%. Okay, let's do the math on that to make it real.
If the member firm raises $1 million from clients like Ingrid, a minimum of $850,000 must go to actually building the strip mall or funding the tech startup or whatever the stated business purpose is. And importantly, offering costs, underwriting discounts, sales commissions, and internal rep incentives do not count toward that 85%.
Ah, there it is. That completely kills the scam you described earlier. A firm cannot raise $1 million and then pay out $300,000 in commissions to Riley and the other reps. That would leave only 70% for the actual business, which violates the 85% threshold of the MPO rule.
Exactly. It forces the capital into the productive enterprise rather than letting the broker-dealer cannibalize the offering through fees.
Okay, I have to interrupt the flow here. Let's say Riley's firm is trying to do this by the book. They raise the money, they strictly adhere to the 85% rule, they drafted all the disclosures. But somebody in the back office made a clerical error and forgot to hit send on the FINRA filing portal. They didn't file it at or before first use, they filed it 2 days late. When the firm discovers this error, what is the regulatory requirement? Do they have to cancel the entire offering, declare it null and void, give all the money back to Ingrid, and burn the project to the ground?
No, they do not. And that is an excellent, highly practical question. The MPO rule anticipates administrative friction. It explicitly states that if a member firm discovers after the fact that a condition was missed or an error was made, their legal duty is to promptly bring the offering into compliance.
So the rule is basically fix it.
Fix it. Do not unwind the entire transaction. You file the document immediately upon discovering the error. You correct the disclosures. You remediate the issue. The regulatory preference is remediation and compliance, not the catastrophic destruction of a fundamentally sound offering over a timing error.
Fix it, don't unwind it. I feel like that is a great mantra for compliance officers and honestly, just a good mantra for life.
Very true.
Are there any other massive gotchas hiding in the MPO rule?
Yes. The biggest, most fundamental gotcha is identifying whether the MPO rule even applies to the fact pattern in the first place. Before you start eagerly calculating 85% thresholds or checking filing dates in an exam question, you must stop and ask one foundational question. Who issued the security?
Who actually created the paper being sold?
Exactly. If Sam, the sponsor, is a completely independent third-party developer and Riley's broker-dealer firm owns 0% of Sam's business and has no control over it, then the member private offering rule does not apply to that transaction, period.
Even though it is a private placement being sold to a retail client?
Even though it is a private placement. The MPO rule only applies when the broker-dealer firm or its control entity is the issuer. Now, to be clear, there are general FINRA rules regarding the filing of third-party private placements that might apply to Sam's deal, but the specific stringent MPO conditions like the absolute mandate of the 85% use of proceeds rule do not apply to third-party offerings. Always identify the issuer first to determine if you are in MPO territory.
So if it's an outside deal, normal suitability and filing rules apply. If it's an inside deal where the firm is selling its own cooking, the MPO rules apply.
Got it. Perfect summary.
Okay, we are rounding the final corner of function three here. Let's talk about the actual mechanics of the transaction. Riley has figured out the rules, he's evaluated the product, he checked the portfolio. Now he actually has to execute the trade for Ingrid. How does he price it, and how does he deal with his competitors in the market? This brings us to fair pricing and the anti-intimidation rules. Let's start with fair pricing.
Fair pricing is heavily dependent on identifying what capacity Riley's firm is acting in for that specific trade. A broker-dealer can act as a principal, or it can act as an agent. The pricing rules change based on that capacity.
Let's define those rules really clearly, because that trips people up. What does it mean to act as a principal?
If the firm is acting as a principal, it means they are trading directly out of their own firm's inventory. The broker-dealer actually owns the security, and they are selling it directly to the customer from their own stockpile, or buying it directly from the customer into their stockpile. When acting as a principal, the firm must buy or sell at a fair price.
And how does FINRA define a fair price?
It takes into account current market conditions, the expense involved in executing the transaction, and crucially, it allows the firm to factor in an entitlement to a profit.
Because they took the actual financial risk of holding that security in their own inventory, they are legally allowed to add a profit markup to the price.
Exactly. Inventory risk justifies a markup. Now contrast that with acting as an agent. If the firm acts as an agent, they do not own the security. They take no inventory risk. They are simply acting as a middleman, matching a buyer with a seller in the open market. In an agency transaction, they do not charge a markup. They charge a fair commission.
And how is a fair commission calculated?
They can weigh current market conditions, the specific expense of executing the order, and the value of the professional service or knowledge they provided to the client. But they cannot factor in a principal profit markup because they didn't take any principal risk.
Okay, so principal equals fair price, which includes a profit markup.
Yeah.
Agent equals fair commission based on service. Now, I have heard older brokers talk about the 5% policy like it's a golden shield. Does that mean Riley can just mark up every single principal trade by 4.9% and be completely immune from regulatory scrutiny?
Absolutely not. That is a dangerous myth. The 5% policy was adopted decades ago, and it is strictly a guide. It is not a hard rule, and it is certainly not a safe harbor. A markup pattern of 5% or even 4% can absolutely be considered unfair and a violation of FINRA rules under certain circumstances, particularly for highly liquid, easily traded securities where margins should be razor thin.
It's a guideline, not a license to overcharge. What about internal expenses? Let's say Riley's firm is a technological dinosaur. Their back office systems are from the 1990s, they are super inefficient, and it costs them an absolute fortune in administrative overhead just to execute a basic trade. Can they just pass all of those excessive internal expenses onto Ingrid in the form of a massive markup or commission?
No. FINRA rules explicitly state that excessive expenses cannot be passed through to justify an unreasonable markup or commission. A high execution cost is a factor a firm can weigh, but a broker-dealer cannot use its own operational inefficiency or bloated overhead to fleece a customer. If it costs you too much to trade, that's your problem, not the client's.
Good. Now, how does fair pricing intersect with the products we've been talking about all day? Private placements. Because I know there are exclusions to the markup policy, and I feel a trap coming.
Your instincts are correct. The exam will test this exact intersection. Does the fair pricing markup policy apply to private placements? The answer is, unequivocally, yes.
But wait, I thought there were specific types of securities that were excluded from the FINRA markup policy.
There are exclusions, but you have to look at the mechanical requirements to qualify for that exclusion. To be exempt from the markup policy, a security offering must meet two conditions simultaneously. First, it must be an offering where a prospectus or offering circular is legally required to be delivered. Second, the security must be sold at a fixed, specific public offering price.
A prospectus and a fixed public price.
Right. Now look at a standard Regulation D private placement. Does it have those two things?
No. By definition, a private placement uses a private placement memorandum, which is not a prospectus. And it is a privately negotiated offering, meaning it does not have a fixed public offering price dictated to the open market.
Exactly. Therefore, a standard private placement fundamentally fails to satisfy the conditions for the exclusion. The fair pricing rules absolutely apply to private placements. You cannot charge an extortionate markup just because the product is unregistered.
What about Regulation A offerings?
Regulation A is the exception to the exception. A Regulation A offering is a unique structure. It does use a formalized offering circular that is similar to a prospectus, and it is typically sold at a stated fixed price. Therefore, a Regulation A offering is excluded from the standard FINRA markup policy, but a standard Regulation D private placement is not.
So Reg A is out, Reg D is in. That is a highly nuanced, highly testable detail.
It is.
Okay, last concept before we move to the recap. Section 5240 of the FINRA manual, the anti-intimidation rule. Honestly, this sounds like it was written to police mobster activity on the trading floor. What exactly is this prohibiting?
It is essentially aimed at preventing cartel behavior and extortion within the financial markets. The rule prohibits a member firm or its associated persons from coordinating prices, threatening other market participants, or retaliating against competitors. You cannot form a cartel to fix spreads, and you cannot use your market weight to extort other firms into doing what you want.
Okay, we'll put that into practice. Let's say Riley absolutely hates a rival brokerage firm across town. He thinks their traders are arrogant, their execution is sloppy, and he just fundamentally dislikes doing business with them. Can Riley unilaterally decide, you know what, I am never routing another trade to that firm again? Or is freezing them out considered a violation of the anti-intimidation rule?
He can absolutely freeze them out. The rule is very careful to protect free market choices. A member firm is perfectly free to set its own bids and offers unilaterally, set its own spreads unilaterally, and decide unilaterally which market makers or broker dealers it will or will not trade with.
So you are legally allowed to be a jerk and refuse to do business with someone as long as it's a unilateral decision made entirely by your firm?
Essentially, yes. You can decide your counterparty risk is too high or you just don't like them. What you cannot do is pick up the phone, call three other brokerage firms, and say, hey, that firm across town is undercutting our commissions. Let's all agree to stop routing trades to them until they raise their prices to match ours. That crosses the line from unilateral business decision to illegal coordination, cartel behavior, and intimidation.
You can act alone, but you can't form a cartel. That makes sense.
And here's the final crucial gotcha for this specific rule. The anti-intimidation rule applies strictly to intermember and intermarket participant conduct. It governs how broker-dealers and market makers treat each other in the marketplace.
It doesn't apply to how a rep treats a retail customer.
No. It is not designed to govern the rep-client relationship. If you see an exam scenario where Riley is being incredibly pushy, aggressive, or using high-pressure sales tactics to intimidate Ingrid into buying a private placement, and the question asks if he violated the anti-intimidation rule, the answer is no.
Wow, really? Even if he is literally intimidating her?
Yes, because it's testing your knowledge of the specific scope of the rule. If he bullies Ingrid, he has probably violated a dozen other rules, like the requirement for fair dealing, high standards of commercial honor, or the Reg BI care obligation. But the specific anti-intimidation rule is strictly reserved for sandbox fights between the financial firms themselves.
Sandbox fights between firms. I love that framing. It keeps the scope of the rule perfectly clear. Well, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We established the initial gateway of Reg BI versus suitability. We dug deep into the four pillars of Reg BI. We broke down the three obligations of suitability and separated churning from quantitative suitability.
Yep.
We analyzed how equity and debt structures must match client objectives. We explored the tiger cage of concentrated portfolios. We unpacked the 85% mandate of the MPO rule. And we just finished fair pricing and cartels.
It is a massive block of material.
It is, which means it is time for the rapid fire recap. This is where we hammer the most testable concepts one last time. I'm going to throw the concepts out. You give me the absolute core punchline the listener needs to memorize. Ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Number one, the boundary between Reg BI and suitability.
Reg BI applies to retail customers, natural persons using the account for personal, family, or household purposes. Suitability applies to institutional clients and business purposes. Mm. A wealthy natural person opening a family trust is still Reg BI. The two rules never stack.
Perfect. Number two, quantitative suitability versus churning.
Churning requires proving the rep had control of the account, A&D, a malicious intent to defraud or generate commissions. Quantitative suitability requires control but does not require intent. It simply means the sheer volume of trades is mathematically excessive and unsuitable for the client's profile.
Right. Bad driver versus taxi hijacker. Number three, equity versus debt structure.
Equity represents ownership, is oriented toward growth, and has a subordinate back-of-the-line claim in bankruptcy. Debt represents a creditor relationship, is oriented toward current income, and has a senior claim. The fundamental structure of the product must match the client's stated objective, regardless of how wealthy they are.
Awesome. Number four, concentrated and speculative portfolios.
Remember the tiger analogy. To recommend extreme concentration, the client must possess both the cage and the trainer. They need holding power, the financial capacity to withstand massive losses, and the investment management talent, the sophistication to understand the complex risks. One without the other is unsuitable.
Excellent. Number five, the member private offering, the MPO rule.
This rule is triggered only when the broker-dealer firm or its control entity is the issuer of the security. It requires physical delivery of disclosures, filing with FINRA at or before first use, and the strict mandate that at least 85% of the offering proceeds must go to the actual business purpose, not to commissions or offering costs.
And finally, number six, Form CRS.
Delivering a generalized Form CRS at account opening never, ever satisfies the specific transactional Reg BI disclosure obligation required when making a recommendation. They are separate duties.
Boom. That is the core of Function 3 locked in.
It is a great summary. But before we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final, slightly provocative thought to ponder as you continue studying this material. We spent a lot of time today dissecting regulation best interest, and we established very clearly that best interest explicitly does not mean you just have to blindly pick the absolute cheapest product on the market.
Right. The whole point of the go-kart analogy, you can't just buy the cheapest thing if it doesn't fit the need.
Exactly. But look at the macroeconomic reality of the financial industry right now. We are racing at breakneck speed toward a world of zero-fee index funds, hyper-transparent pricing, and algorithmic robo-advisors that manage money for almost nothing. The baseline cost of investing is trending toward zero.
Yeah, that's true.
So think about this. As you pass this exam and become a fully licensed financial professional, if you are sitting across a desk from a client, how are you going to prove in your written documentation and in your verbal rationale that the highly complex, illiquid, and significantly more expensive private placement you just recommended was truly, undeniably in their best interest compared to a nearly free, perfectly liquid S&P 500 index fund?
Oof. That is the real existential challenge of the job, isn't it?
It is. Because mastering this material isn't just about memorizing rules to pass a multiple choice test on a Tuesday morning. It is about learning how to rigorously, legally, and ethically defend your professional judgment in the real world, when real money, real market crashes, and real regulatory scrutiny are on the line.
Yeah.
How do you articulate and prove the value of what you are providing when your solution costs more? That is the true ongoing test of best interest.
That is heavy, but it is incredibly important. You have to be able to justify your existence and your recommendations in a hyper-competitive market. Well, if you are studying for the Series 82, you have got this. Keep hammering these concepts, remember the analogies, especially the tiger cage, and trust your preparation. Good luck on the exam, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.